program that specializes in amateur radio in the Valley and around the world. Whether you're already a ham or have always wanted to be one, you'll find out about interesting events and issues regarding amateur radio. Your host is Lynn Winkler, KB7LPW. To get in touch with Lynn, call 230-2755. That's 230-2755. Or outside the local area, call 1-800-293-KFNN. Ham Radio and More is brought to you by AEA Incorporated, Wallpaper World, and Ken Nichols. Now, here's the host of Ham Radio and More, Lynn Winkler.
CQ, 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 Arizona. Welcome to Ham Radio and More, the only show of its kind in America. I'm your host, Lynn Winkler, KB7LPW, and today's show is sponsored by Wallpaper World, AEA Incorporated, and Ken Nichols of Linda Brack Auto Mall. Our phone number, as usual, is 230-2755, 230-2755, or if you really live way out there in DX land, 1-800-293-KFNN, like from Prescott, 1-800-293-KFNN. And today's show, we're going to have, we have Al Gross in studio, WAPAL. I'm honored to have him again. And, of course, Al is the father of personal use radio and so many other things that we're going to try to get into all of that. And we're also going to talk about Samuel Morris, and we're going to talk about Mr. Sarnoff of RCA and how he said he had the priority of invention for the first walkie-talkie, and how Al fought the system and won, I guess I can say, and a lot of other things. I've got some secret classified documents that I'm going to read from 1945, so anybody that's interested in things that occurred during World War II, this should be an interesting show also. So we're going to talk about a lot of different things, but first, as usual, a few QSTs. One, aside from the old 1945 and earlier dates, immediately following the show at 2 p.m. today, the amateur television group, Arizona Amateurs on TV, is having their meeting at 2 p.m. That's 2 p.m., and it is at Channel 25 Television, Channel 25 TV at 1 West Lone Cactus Drive, which is Central Avenue, just south of Deer Valley Road. And you're welcome to go there. Again, it's the Arizona Amateurs on Television. And Kenneth Casey, N7RPN, he is the owner of Channel 25, and he's going to give a tour of the station, which should be very interesting. It's a low-power television station, and they expect a big turnout. So go down to Channel 25 today, 2 o'clock, get in the car, you know, 1:45, 1:30, turn the station on while you're driving, and everybody appear at Channel 25 for the Arizona Amateurs on Television monthly meeting. It should be fun. The next major event that takes place is going to be Sunday, November 1st, and that's going to be, of course, the West Valley Amateur Radio Club Swap Meet, and that's going to be on 98th Avenue and Bell Road at the Merrill Lynch parking lot. That's 98th Avenue and Bell in Sun City. Al, you don't, not too far from there, you can go to this one on November 1st, and it's going to be from 8 a.m. till noon. And it's going to be a swap meet, so, you know, they'll have some good products to buy, sell, and trade. West Valley Amateur Radio Club is going to put that on. October the 31st, there's going to be, of course, the next Packet Users Group meeting. And, again, that's going to be October 31st, Halloween, wear your costumes. And that's at 8:30 in the morning at Denny's, I-17 in Dunlap. And they expect to have quite a few people there, and they had a lot last time. It should be very interesting. They're going to talk about emergency communications. They're going to practice a run in support of the Best Damn Bike Race in November, so they're going to have a trial run on that. If you want information, you can call Barney, of course, KB7KOE, at 861-2817, 861-2817 for the next Packet Users Group get together. This coming week, there's going to be a Ham Fest, October 18th, and that's going to be in Tucson. So if you want to go to Tucson, the Tucson Ham Fest, sponsored by the Old Pueblo Radio Club, That's going to be October 18th from 7 a.m. to noon at the De Anza Drive-In, 22nd and Alvin and Ray in Tucson. $4 for sellers, free for buyers. There's going to be hourly drawings, an ARCA meeting, a repeater owner meeting, Arizona Packet Node Operator meeting, amateur radio gear, computers, all kinds of stuff. Talk-in frequency will be 146.22, 146.28, and 146.52 simplex. And if you want more information, give A.J. Pawlowski, KB7KZ, a call. His phone number is 742-2605, 742-2605. That's the Tucson Ham Fest, October the 18th. So there's certainly a lot going on. Of course, December 5th at the Superstition Amateur Radio Club Ham Fest, and that takes place in the Mesa Community College, Saturday again, December 5th. And for more information, give Bill Howes a call, KG7XB, at 380-4839. That's a Superstition Amateur Radio Club Ham Fest, December 5th. That's going to be a big, big ham fest. And then if you have your calendar and you want to make it, mark a date for 1993, March 12th, 13th, and 14th will be the next Scottsdale Amateur Radio Club's Spring Fest 93. It's going to be transmitter hunts, VE exams, prizes, all kinds of stuff. And that's March 12th, 13th, and 14th. Ron Avery is the chairman of that, WB6PEB. His phone number, 391-2388, 391-2388. Can't say we don't pass out a lot of information here. But I couldn't make it to the QCWA Scottsdale convention yesterday. If anybody was there, Jerry, if you're listening perchance, if you give us a call at 230-2755 and give us a brief summary of what happened at the QCWA convention, or if anybody who's listening was there, just be interested in hearing a little bit about what went on there, because I know they had their national convention. Give us a call, 230-2755, 1-800-293-KFMN. Remember that the next Lorraine McCarthy's Weekend Technician No Code class, just a three-day event, and for just in 3 days, Friday from 7 to 10 p.m., Saturday from 9 to 5 p.m., and Sunday from 9 to 6 p.m., you can get your No Code license. She gives you a great class, gives you a lot of guide to how to study and everything, and then gives you the test at the end of the class. It's $95, but in 3 days you'll be a ham radio operator, not guaranteed, but almost guaranteed. About almost everybody passes this. So if you want more information about that, to register for December 11th, 12th, and 13th, December 11th, 12th, and 13th, give her a call at 714-979-2633, 714-979-2633. 2633. Being a ham radio operator nowadays is easier than ever before. The test is a lot easier than it ever has been before. You don't even need Morse code on the opening level. Okay, what else do we have? There was a transmitter hunt last night, and it was a lot of fun. One of the best transmitter hunts of recent memory. Not that it was real, real, real tricky, but it was fun because it wasn't too hard, yet it wasn't too easy, and it required quite a bit of portable transmitter hunting. There were 11 teams involved, 10 hunting teams, and of course the one team that hid. And Chuck, who was in the hiding team since he went on his first tee hunt the month before and did manage to win that one, was a hider this time, and he had a ball doing the hiding. We started, of course, at 7th Avenue and Camelback in the Target Shopping Center. And again, there were 10 teams that all started out. And what was interesting is that my normal partner, John Moore, MJ7E, unfortunately was not feeling very well last night and was not able to attend the tee hunt. So I didn't know that until about an hour before the tee hunt begins, an hour and a half. So I made a quick dash to John's home. And he had some wood. So I'm going to show you how easy it is to become a tee hunter. I had to use my car that I drive, which is not what I would call a normal tee hunting vehicle. But anyway, I was at John's house, and I have a sunroof in my vehicle. And John had some plywood. And we took a saw and measured, and we cut this plywood to fit across the sunroof. We then
we then made a 1-inch circular hole in the center of the plywood, and we put the plywood right on top of where the sunroof goes from edge to edge, and then closed the sunroof as far as it could up to that point so it held the board in place very tightly. We then dropped this sniffer that we use, antenna, that had a metal mast to it, with the coax, of course, through the hole. And now listen to this. First we had, on my armrest, we had to come down and sit on my armrest, but of course that's a leather armrest, and that would get ruined very easily, so I put a piece of, I had a clipboard. But what happened is, when we would drive, you know, the clipboard would slide and this metal mast would slide, so it wasn't very, very good. So, on the way to the T-Hunt at 7th Avenue and Camelback, I had to stop at my house, and I was searching for something to use. What could I put on my armrest to prevent this from sliding? Well, it just so happened, I don't know how I thought of it or anything, but I was lucky. I looked at a cooler, that had a small cooler at the top that comes off. It had the two spots for cups, and in the middle, it, for some reason, just has a little circular indentation. I took it, I put it on my armrest, tightened it with rubber bands to the armrest, and believe it or not, the mast fit right into that little hole, absolutely perfect, and stood straight up. The antenna was absolutely straight up. Anyway, that's how easy it is to set up a T-hunting vehicle, let me tell you. It was just that easy. So anybody out there that has had qualms about going into a T-hunt because they don't have a Doppler, they don't have this, they don't have that, you don't need all that. You can make yourself a real small beam or just a little sniffer that we have and use a little mast, and it's just this simple. You don't have to drill all kinds of holes in your car or any or your truck or anything like that. Anyway, so the T-hunt started at 7 p.m. sharp, and it was a north, absolutely north, straight north signal that we all got, and we headed. Oh, and in the front seat, John's daughter, N7MAT, Beth, went along with us, and so did Lori, my daughter, N7UKZ. And anyway, Beth was going to be the navigator, which she did an excellent job for our team, let me tell you. Anyhow, everybody headed up north, got way late a little bit at north of Dunlap. There were a lot of confusion, a lot of vehicles were in that particular area, and they decided it was not on the south side of the mountains there. So they started going, of course, on Dunlap and on, Hatcher and different streets, going to 7th Street, taking 7th Street north. We did that also, and when we got to Thunderbird, when we were driving up 7th Street, passing the Point Tapatia, I said to Beth, I know where it is. It's going to be north of, south of Thunderbird, right off of Central. And sure enough, the signal was showing in that direction constantly. Every signal we got was pretty good. We were able to get a good signal. There was no problem with the signal strength or anything. Anyhow, sure enough, we got to Thunderbird, made our left turn, went to Central, made a left turn, and we said, it has to be here, and this is where the mountain preserve is and everything. Well, this is when you should listen to instinct sometimes rather than just your equipment. Beth said, it's here. It's right here. We were the first car there. Said, this is here. It's right here. We got to get out. I said, well, let me check. Let's sit here and wait till we get another signal, because, you know, it's 30 seconds on, a minute and a half off. That's how we do it here in Phoenix for the transmitter hunts. Well, the next signal came. I took off the rubber ducky on a handy talkie I had, and it did not even register one S unit. Not even one. So I said, can't be here. We're not close enough. So we took off. Well, of course, that was the wrong thing to do. But we went east. We went west, following along the mountain preserve, and every reading we took again pointed back to Central. So when we got back there again, we were about the fifth or sixth vehicle there. All the T-hunters were there already. Anyway, we got out on foot, took this, this was great. We took the contraption off. It was easy to take the contraption off, and we went, the three of us, in the dark with a little flashlight, we, of course, were sixth. We were not first, second, third, fourth, fifth, but we were sixth. So we weren't seventh, eighth, ninth, or tenth either. And Beth, if we would have listened to her initially, we probably would have come in first or second, which would have been great. But we were very pleased. It was a lot of fun. We were pleased that we found it because it was the first time we used the equipment in my vehicle. So, Jan, at least we didn't finish last. So, you know, give your daughter a pat on the back. She did a good job. And the winning team, and it was a good job by the hiders, in fact, because it was kind of neat, because when you got out and you started walking, you had to go through brush and all kinds of stuff. I mean, we got grass and bushes and all kinds of stuff on us. But then there was a little path. We took that path. You had to probably walk a good 400 or 500 feet. Incline, and then you had to go down a pretty steep cliff there in order to get to another flatland, and he was hidden around a bunch of bushes. He was flying flat, and of course Chuck the sneak kept changing the amount of power he was giving out, moving his beam, and he was really low to the ground. The beam was right on the ground, basically, so he did throw everybody off a little bit, but it was great. The winning team was Bill and Bonnie Pinup, KC7VV and WT7Z. Team Beam, as they call it. And they use Dopplers for their truck, and then they use, when they're portable, a beam with a signal strength meter. That signal strength meter, John, sure helps knowing how close you are, John. The signal strength meter. okay, and then coming in number two was, and listen to this name of this team, number two was the Bambi Blasters. I don't know if they're hunters or not, but the Bambi Blasters. Pete and Larry Asplund, KB7JCD and N7SNA, respectively. And Chris and Laura Wadecki, N7TWW and N7TWY. So the next transmitter hunt, the second Saturday in November, 7 p.m., it's going to be an east side start, That means we get together on the northeast corner of Scottsdale Road and Thomas. That's the second Saturday of November, so I want to see everybody out there, at least another 4 or 5 teams. Okay, I want to talk about next week. We're going to have Larry Dilley, and we're going to have Norm Sharp here talk about amateur television. The following week, we're going to have Joe Fairclough, and Joe, of course, is a teacher in New York, and he's going to talk about how amateur radio is used in his English class. It's kind of really a unique story. The following week, November 1st, Dave Kelly's birthday, the president of TRIARC, or the director of TRIARC, November 1st. He's going to turn 40, that old man. And anyway, that day we're going to have Mike Zussman on here, and we're going to talk about a little about the history of amateur radio here in Phoenix, which should be very interesting. He's got some great stories. In fact, he told me one last night about how he got the nickname of God and why he wears that on his hat. Derogatory about it. That's what he wears. It's kind of interesting, the story and how he got it. That should be an interesting show. The week after that, we're going to have Len Traubman from San Francisco. He's going to talk about how he saved the life of a gentleman in Russia via amateur radio. Also about his, he developed actually a cassette and pamphlet that talks about, uses normal English ham radio lingo and translates it into Russian. And that's kind of unique and kind of interesting, and he does sell it. It's a not-for-profit organization. It's very inexpensive, and you can buy it reasonably priced. We're going to talk about that. The following week, we're not sure yet. And the week, the 15th, and the week after that, we have Lorraine McCarthy, who's going to give us a little indication of how to learn, some teaching methods on how to learn what you need to know about amateur radio and some other things. So Lorraine will be our guest that week. That should be interesting. And we have a new contest, courtesy of Cobra Dynascan in Chicago, Illinois, the Dynascan Corporation. They have given us a model LD-200 Cobra laser detector.
a LIDAR is what they call it. And there's some interesting things about this particular, I guess they're the first one to have a LIDAR detector on the market, and that actually works. And it's a quite an interesting unit. I guess it'll work about a mile and a half, 30 feet wide. LIDAR stands for light detection and ranging. While everyone refers to it as laser, the correct name is LIDAR. How is LIDAR different from radar? Well, radar guns transmit microwave signals and receive them back once they have been deflected by a vehicle. LIDAR, however, uses light pulses or laser, with each pulse measuring the distance to a vehicle. The vehicle's speed is then calculated by measuring how quickly the pulses are reflected. I'm not going to read right now all the different things about how it works and stuff. It's kind of interesting. For instance, can LIDAR operate through glass? Well, the answer is no, it cannot operate through glass. So that means that the police can't sit in their car and shine it through their glass. It doesn't work. So LIDAR cannot operate through any glass. The oblique angles of most windshields reduce the effective range. Tinted windshields also block the infrared emissions, making operation impossible. But the laser pulse can be received through glass too easily and quickly. But the laser pulse can be received through glass to easily and quickly trigger a laser detector alarm, which is what a LIDAR does. So Cobra has given us one to give away. I guess its value is about $100 or so. What we're going to do is we're going to give it away November 29th, and we need a postcard or a QSL card, or you're welcome to drop just a piece of paper here, and we're going to have a drawing. No purchase necessary, void, we're prohibited by law. November the 29th. All you need to do is send me a QSL card or a postcard. Send it to LIDAR Contest, KFNM, 4800 North Central, Phoenix, Arizona, 85012. 4800 North Central, Phoenix, Arizona, 85012. And we will have a drawing November 29th, courtesy of Dynascan Cobra. And they promise that they're going to give us more and more things to give away. And they've got some great stuff, scanners and radar detectors and CB sets. So, and speaking of CB, I have in my hot little hand here the first CB-er. CB number 1, which was issued March the 22nd, 1948. It's a funny picture or a caricature of a gentleman sitting before me, Al Gross, with his, and I recognize this handy talkie because I've seen it numerous times in his specialty briefcase that he carries it around, but with this little dipole that sits on it that looks kind of weird but works quite well. And it's Al Gross, and his first CB-er call sign was 19W0001, issued March 22nd, 1948. And this wasn't for 27 megahertz. I mean, you know, that most people think of CB today, personal use radio. It was what, for 450? Okay. So he's had so many licenses, experimental licenses. It's amazing, and we're going to take a little break here. When we come back, we're going to talk to Al and find out all this good gossip and all the things he did. Let me tell you, 4 hours isn't enough to just talk about half the things that he's done, but we're going to try to go through them, and I've got some secret documents I'm going to read that was right a month before the end of World War II. That is James Bond stuff. It really is. Don't tell the CIA we're going to read this stuff. So it should be interesting. So stick with us. This is Ham Radio and More on KFNN. If you want to get online and talk to Al, I mean, here's your chance. If a lot of you have seen him at the Ham Radio clubs, but here's your chance to ask him questions one-on-one. 230-2755. 230-2755. We'd be happy to take your call.
Another week, another 2 pounds gone. It's that simple. Yes, losing weight is that easy when you have help. The kind of help you get with Jenny Craig, the weight loss program that works. Roy Baldwin here, and I'm inviting you to join the team, the Jenny Craig Success Team. You get one-on-one counseling, sensible weekly classes with down-to-earth answers for your weight problem. I do mean problem. For instance, try this. Figure out how much weight you'd like to lose, 20, 30, 40 pounds, and pack that much in a suitcase. Carry it around for a while. Tough, isn't it? Well, you're putting that kind of strain on your body and your heart every day. So don't delay another day. Just $99 for all the weight you want to lose to stop carrying around that extra weight. Jenny's Cuisine is extra, of course, but it's great food and snacks. In fact, you're never hungry, and the weight really goes. Call 263-9366. Get started today. 7 locations in the Valley. There's sure to be one convenient to your work or home. Don't carry those pounds around anymore. Call Jenny Craig. 263-9366.
Comfort and productivity go hand in hand. Desk chairs, especially when they're designed with the human body in mind, can mean the difference between high and low productivity, as well as the level of fatigue one experiences at the end of the day. Designer Seatworks has just the chair. Upholstered in leather, ergonomically designed, the chairs from Designer Seatworks add class, comfort, and style to your office. Manufactured right here in the Valley, you can buy factory direct. Interior designers are welcome, and with many different colors to choose, these chairs will enhance any decor. Standard features include 5-spoke
strap. Call 230-2755. That's 230-2755. Or outside the local dialing area, call 1-800-293-KFNN. Now, with more about amateur radio, here's your host, Lynn Winkler.
CQ, we're back, and welcome again to Ham Radio and More. And I'm here, Lynn Winkler, with my guest, Al Gross, W8POL, longtime amateur radio operator. Don't think he's currently a member of the ARRL, but we won't get into that on this show today. However, Al started in about 1927 with an obsession for amateur radio, and he's been invited to so many different places and to doing so many things. I mean, he's going to be a guest of honor in New York next month, right, for the Radio Club of America. Of which he's an honorary everything, and IEEE, he's on every different board and stuff. So, Al, tell us again, just briefly, just how you started into radio. What triggered you?
Well, at the age of 9, aboard a steamboat plying the Great Lakes, my parents were taking an excursion to Buffalo, New York. And as a young boy, I was nosy and wandering around the ship. And I got up to the top floor of the ship, and I heard a rather unusual buzzing sound. And I wandered over to an open door, and here I looked in, and there was the radio operator working spark gap wireless. And I could hear the buzzing and the crashing of the spark gap that he was using for transmitting to the shore. And as I was watching him, he waved me to come in, and he sat me on his lap, and he put the earphones on my ear so I can hear what was going on, and I think that convinced me that radio was for me.
And radio sure was, because just reading some of the things that you've done, in 1941, designed, developed, and invented the handheld walkie-talkie and circuits operating at frequencies above 200 megahertz. It's funny because you hear that surface mount technology is new, and circuit boards are new, and all this is new, and you've been doing it for years. You were the first one to do it.
Well, in order to miniaturize, you had to do technologies that were a little ahead of the time, using small vacuum tubes and small components. And you know, you mentioned megahertz. It reminds me of a million rent-a-cars someplace. I used to call it megacycles.
Megacycles, yeah. No, that's a big thing of yours, I know. but most of us don't remember that far back. You know. Okay, World War II. Let's move quickly through most of this, because I want to get to some other things. Let's go to the Joan Eleanor thing, which is kind of interesting. That was basically, in a nutshell, what was Joan Eleanor?
Well, that was the code name for a combination of a transceiver that would be used by an operator on the ground, a very small thing that he could carry with him when he was parachuted out of an airplane. And the other part of the equipment was mounted in a Mosquito British two-engine bomber. And that looked very much like a CB radio connected to a wire recorder.
and with an antenna that not too different than what you did with your sunroof, the antenna went down through the camera well in the aircraft, and we could rotate it also so that it was a dipole, because a dipole would give us the kind of pattern that we wanted for radiation. And the agent on the ground, or the operator on the ground, who was usually working with the resistance forces in occupied territory, would have this small transceiver, and incidentally it operated at 250 megahertz, which is very close to channel 13 today. And the reason I chose those frequencies was the Germans did not have receiving equipment at those frequencies, and they couldn't DF on it too well.
Well, it wasn't even the entire war. They never did get that kind of frequency technology, did they?
No, not really. And so it reminds me a little of your treasure hunt, because you had to use directive antennas to do that, and we did the same thing during World War II.
Not as... we were less sophisticated, trust me. At least my team was less sophisticated.
But anyway, and you weren't in occupied territory.
No, that, and we didn't have to use code words.
Right.
And we had a transmission every, it was supposed to be on time and everything.
Yeah, but the unique part about our work is that because of the characteristics of the frequency and the fact that you couldn't direction find on it, we could speak an English language, but we did have certain words that were used to determine whether the person on the ground was being played back by occupying forces. So we did have certain codes, but they were in the form of phrases.
Now, how did you get picked to basically do the technology for this?
Well, what happened was that I received some publicity on my handheld transceivers prior to the war. This was the 1939-1940 time frame. And then after the war began, December 7th, 1941, it was shortly thereafter, in 1942, that I got called to Washington by members of the Office of Strategic Services to demonstrate the walkie-talkie to them, which I did. And based on what they wanted and the activity that they wanted to become engaged in, they thought my device would be suitable for that purpose. And I was given the, I was commissioned to do that work, to develop that system from 1942 to 1943.
And tell everybody how clandestine it was, how you know, you operated in Cleveland in a beautiful surroundings. They gave you thousands of square feet, millions of security.
Well, what it was is at the time we had the project started, it was the aim of the project people that the information would be available to our President of the United States at that time, Franklin Roosevelt, who wanted to get daily information that was fresh. Most of the information that came through wireless telegraphy was usually coded and encoded, and generally it wasn't delivered timely enough to suit the President, whereas Winston Churchill was getting all the data daily from his people that were in occupied territory. So, therefore, this project would afford the President an opportunity to get this information quickly and clearly, be able to analyze it, and be able to determine just what actions would have to be taken by our forces, because as Commander-in-Chief, he needed that. That was the purpose, the original intent of the project.
Okay. And you had how many employees? Basically.
Well, we started with a couple of hams, by the way.
Really?
And we couldn't do the production in Cleveland. We had to go to a community in Youngstown, Ohio, about 55 miles southeast of Cleveland. And we got an old house, very old house right next to a machine shop. And I was given the money to acquire the machine shop and the old house, because I needed the machinery and tools to build. And the old house was kept that way. It was kept like looking like a house, but we had a tunnel running between the machine shop and the house. And it was through this tunnel that we went back and forth in carrying out our activity. The assembly of the finished product was done in the attic, which had been refurbished for that purpose. But the rest of the house looked very much like an ordinary house. And eventually I hired more people. We had a total of about a dozen people working on the radio sets at that time. And the equipment that went in the aircraft required recording. And at that time, the only means for recording was on wire. So we used a wire recorder and a thing that looked very much like a present-day CB radio, which operated at 250 megahertz. And that was mounted in the aircraft. The code name for that was Eleanor. The code name for the handheld unit on the ground was Joan. Therefore, that during the war, we had to use code names for equipment like that.
And you delivered these when they were done. You took a train to Washington, and you you hand-delivered them.
Yes. After the sets were tested and completed, and we certified that we had them on frequency and everything was working as it should, I would take a group of sets, perhaps six or eight sets, in a regular suitcase, and they would go with me on the plane on the train overnight to Washington, D.C. I'd get off at Silver Springs, Maryland, and there was a car waiting for me at that time with an OSS personnel, and we would drive to 25 and East Street in Washington where the headquarters were, and that's how we delivered the sets.
Well, I have in front of me, don't know how I got this secret document here, but a memorandum of information for the Joint U.S. Chiefs of Staff. This is dated July 6, 1945, and this is an original from the Office of Strategic Services, Washington, D.C., reference memorandum of information for the Joint U.S. Chiefs of Staff, subject OSS penetration of Germany, dated 15th of June, 1945. Now, you know, this is something you just don't pick up off the street every day. I mean, this was an actual memorandum right before the war actually ended. One, the first successful operational use of specific ground air systems of voice communication for intelligent reports was made by OSS during the closing months of the European War. The equipment perfected by OSS is known as JE, Joan Eleanor. In actual operation, it proved a valuable new tool for penetration of any desired depth into enemy territory. Because of its portability and superior security features, Joan Eleanor has important advantages over wireless telegraphy in certain specific situations. Now, you got to realize this is history as it happened. I mean, that's why I'm reading this. I'm taking the time to read a real document. This is what really went on. The equipment carried by the ground agent affords maximum possibilities of concealment, as the two pocket size units and collapsible antenna weigh less than 4 pounds. Well, today it doesn't weigh 6 ounces, but okay, all right, 4 pounds isn't too bad. And there is no dependence on outside power supply. The danger of detection through enemy monitoring is minimized by the high frequency used, 250 megahertz, high frequency used in the selective beam pattern cast upward, which, that was because of the dipole, right, that you used, the weird shaped, which make it improbable that the enemy will ever hear the signals. Hence, except for messages involving top security, the necessity of coding is not, I don't know what it is, but I know it's not needed. Well, that's not the word here, but it's eliminated. Oh, there it is. I tried to read this because, believe me, it's like a... and makes it possible in some instances to receive requested information at once. Both sides of the ground air conversation are recorded in the plane for purposes of accuracy and as a check on the identity of the ground operator. Imagine, in 1945 they had a contact with Joan Eleanor lasting 15 or 20 minutes can supply a greater volume of intelligence than several days of wireless, I guess it's wireless, it's hard to read it, W/something.
Wireless telegraphy.
Okay, wireless telegraphy. Transmission under normal circumstances. It is also possible for a plane in the course of a single mission to make more than one such contact if the agents are so located as to make this practical. four, to place Joan Eleanor into actual operation under combat conditions required careful planning and coordination with the AAP, which have throughout given excellent cooperation. While it is possible to train a Joan Eleanor ground agent in a few hours of classroom work and a short period of practice in communicating with the plane, the air operator must have knowledge of aircraft operations and flying conditions and must possess physical and psychological qualifications of the highest order. Did you screen each one of the people that were involved in this?
They had to be screened.
But not one had ever was ever captured, is that right?
No, there were no one was captured. There were one or two that lost their equipment, but we were able to recover the people after that.
Well, they got to go through physical and psychological qualifications of the highest order. The first successful operation was accomplished in November 1944 with an agent placed in Holland. Between January 21st and April 24th, 12 teams were introduced directly into Germany, where they were placed in key cities. Joan Eleanor's security features enabled two of these teams to work in Berlin without ever being detected. 29 missions were flown between March 19th and April 25th. The accumulation of operational experience resulted in exceptionally good contacts toward the end of this period, although some failures did occur at the start. Thus, except for attempts which failed to reach the target area, every mission but one of those flown during the last week of these operations produced useful results. An example of the effective use is cited in reference C and set for, is that in here?
Yeah.
Okay.
Should have it.
Wait a minute. The value system was dramatically shown, here's the appendix, when an OSS operator in a plane 30,000 feet in the air received the following. I mean, this is a real communication here. Via Joan Eleanor from an agent speaking from near Munich. Unessentials I deleted from this transcript. Hello, Vic. This is Freddie calling. The Wilhelm Railway Junction has from 40 to 50 trains passing through all night. In Wilhelm proper, there are two airplane factories. Number one is the Dornier Works, and the second is a factory making spare parts for planes. Peissenberg is nearby. It is the last coal mine out of which the Germans are now obtaining coal within the Reich to send to Berchtesgaden. Gassen, is that how you pronounce it? The spare airplane parts and the completed parts from Dornier plant are shipped by rail to Garmisch in the mountains. You must absolutely knock out the railway line, Wilhelm-Feissenberg. And Wilhelm-Ausberg as soon as possible. This line must be knocked out. I have something else to say to you. You must not bomb Raisting under any circumstances. The people are 90% on our side, and so is the entire Volkssturm. Raisting, do not bomb it, please. This intelligence was immediately forwarded to the Air Force, which decided to bomb the Wilhelm target and the nearby Peissing railway station in Munich on the same mission. At the time this raid took place, a rather heavy overcast prevented an immediate estimate of damage from the air. And one other mission was flown to the same agent the night after the bombing. He reported, "I want to thank you for almost killing me yesterday. I was in Munich and I was 800 meters from the Peissing station when it was attacked. Now an eyewitness report. Peissing station was hit directly during the bombing attack yesterday about 1100. Railroad traffic in the direction of the mountains and Garmisch was halted and is paralyzed. All trucks are destroyed. In the double bombing attack at Wilhelm, the station and the tracks were hit. Only the aircraft plant Fairdorf, which we were talking about, was nearly undamaged. After conversing with the agent, the Jones Eleanor plane dropped to low altitude and photographed the Wilhelm damage. The photographs and the agent's report were delivered to the AAF immediately. The town of Raisting was not bombed." And this was declassified August 9th, 1979. So it was, 55, 65, 75, 34 years before they declassified this. I know I took a few minutes reading it, but I just thought that was kind of interesting. I mean, that was, as it happened, very, very interesting.
And of course, you had a part in that, so it's kind of...
Well, I had to design and build the equipment, and they appreciated it that they were able to use it and not get killed using it, so... Okay, that was that's one thing. That was kind of interesting. All right, I want to take a minute to talk about AEA Incorporated. AEA Incorporated makes so many different products, but the one common thread that all the AEA products have is that AEA builds them with fantastic quality. And they back it up with service. If anything goes wrong, they take care of it. I mean, you can call them up. They respond. They make antennas that are stealthy, just like Al Gross does. They make an antenna if you're in a restricted area. Speaking of restricted areas, Munich, Germany during the war, they have an isoloop antenna, which is basically people can't see it, and it's great for 10 through 30 megahertz. It's a fantastic antenna. It's very hard to see, and it works great. And so if you have a problem with people seeing what's going on, you know, they don't like it, you're a restricted area, they don't want any antennas up, this is a product for you, the isoloop. Then they have the isopole, which are omnidirectional UHF and VHF antennas. Of course, they have the VSB70 fast scan transceiver, which works really good if you want to get on amateur television. And they, of course, also have an antenna and amplifier to go along with it. They have the Morris machine, which is probably, it's not probably, it is the most well-known keyer trainer there is. It does everything. It'll teach you code, it'll help you with QSOs, simulator, contest simulators, everything. The keyer trainer. Then, of course, if you're into weather facts, they have the AEA facts. And then when it comes to packet, they make the PK88 TNC, which is just HF-VHF packet TNC, which works fantastic. I see more and more on packet every day. Or they make a PCB88, which is the same controller, actually fits into your computer. Just a simple module, goes right into your computer, takes up no space on your bench or your workspace, just goes right into your computer. Works great. Then they have, of course, the new DSP2232. A little pricey, but it does so much if you want a multi-mode data controller. And, of course, the PK232 with over 50,000 sold all over the world. They have all the software to back all these things up, all these products up. And then, of course, they have their world clock and a few other things. AEA Incorporated make great products. Talk to your friends if they're on packet. I'll bet you 3-1 they use an AEA PK232 or an 88, and they do work great. So if you want to see the entire line of AEA products, you can go to Ham Radio Outlet, which of course is located at 17th Avenue in Camelback, and they have the entire line in stock, good pricing on the AEA line, big discounts, and good place to buy, of course, the equipment, and of course they have them right there, so you can take it with you instead of ordering it and having to wait for it. So see Ham Radio Outlet for AEA Incorporated, where the hot action is at. They do make a nice catalog too. In fact, when I was in HRO last week, I saw they have some of the 1992 catalogs there from AEA, so stop in and pick one up. Okay, there's not enough time in this segment to discuss Samuel Morris or to discuss actually David Sinoff, so we're going to do that in the next hour. But I'm just going to go through some of these other things, Al, that you've done. At the request of the FCC, you supply technology needed for the rules and regulations for personal use radio. And that was back in 1947. In 1947, at the World Telecommunications Conference in Atlantic City, New Jersey, 82 countries in attendance, your walkie-talkies were finally demonstrated.
Oh, it was done very successfully. But if you want to come back a little further, towards the tail end of the war, I met another amateur radio operator, George Sterling.
Aha, I heard his name before.
Yeah, W1AE. George Sterling was chief engineer of the FCC and also head of the Radio Intelligence Division for the Federal Communications Commission. It was through that relationship that I got to meet him, and then he, in turn, showed the walkie-talkie that we used in the OSS to members of the commission. It was that particular interval that created an extreme interest in the mind of the commissioners, including Commissioner Jack Jett, Commissioner Russell Hyde, and Charles Denny, the chairman of the commission. And that was the genesis of the idea of, after the war, of having something on that order for personal use radio. Then subsequently, the promulgation of the rules and regulations began in about 1946-1947 time frame, and then the World Telecommunication Conference in Atlantic City took place, and the commissioners were present at that particular affair, and all 87 countries agreed on the idea. They were very enthused about having personal radio.
But they didn't, but did they drop the ball, though? They didn't really take it, did they, and develop it for each of these countries?
No, not really. There were so many things happening over in Europe, as you no doubt know, with the Cold War, and there were other elements that went into it, because each government had its own post and telegraph equivalent to our FCC, and they all had their own ideas on frequency allocations and their usage, and consequently, it's sort of stagnated for a while up until recent years. So it didn't assume any popularity until September 1948, when the 27 megahertz CB band was opened up, and when CB radios became quite evident and the truckers were using it. The truckers over in Europe introduced it there in a clandestine sort of way, and it was being used in that manner over in Europe. That created a sort of a problem with the European Post and Telegraphs, who had to make up their mind on what they were going to do with the personal two-way radio.
Interesting. And of course, here in this country, right after that, you made a few radios, and somebody decided to buy some, 25,000 of them.
Yeah, right. Well, that was Montgomery Ward, and they wanted to use it for farmers. And that was the true advent of merchandising to somebody, which was a customer. And then the U.S. Coast Guard wanted a militarized version of the same radio.
But they didn't realize the potential to get everybody with one of these walkie-talkies in their hands. I mean, how much were they at that time? I mean, what did they, like, sell for? I mean, I know they can't equate today's dollars with then, but...
They were $179 for a single radio. A pair would be about double that.
Wow. Was there a big markup on it? I mean, you don't have to tell us how much.
Well, that was the retail price. But they had a version of it that would plug into a power supply that could be used for a base station. So the type of models that were available were essentially an outgrowth of the handheld unit.
And how much power did they put out?
About a watt and a half.
And they were on 450.
And they were 450, 460. And even today, you know, there's either 8 or 10 channels up there that are delegated for this particular personal use radio.
And they work. You had a battery, obviously. The battery was bigger than the handy-talkie, right?
Well, a little bit bigger. they kept coming down in size, and they were good for about 4 hours' worth of operation. And then, of course, for the base station, it was a small power supply.
Were those batteries rechargeable at that time, or no?
No, not at that time. So that came later.
So you could use them for 4 hours, then you had to buy another one.
Yeah, don't forget, we had very tiny miniature vacuum tubes. We weren't yet in solid state.
Well, I understand that, but still, 4 hours. I wonder how much did that battery cost for 4 hours?
They weren't expensive. They were quite inexpensive. So that wasn't really the motivating problem for marketing the sets.
Okay. Well, our phone number here is 230-2755, 230-2755, and we'll be happy to take your calls, or 1-800-293-KFNN if you have any calls for Al that I'm not going to touch on for some reason. You're welcome to give us a call. This is a once-in-a-lifetime, not once-in-a-lifetime, but it's once-in-a-short-time operation to have the living legend of, I like that, the living legend of personal use radio and radio in all its different varieties here live. Actually, very, very interesting. And we're going to discuss again Samuel Morse and David Sinoff and RCA and a few other things in the next hour. And we invite your participation. We also have a contest, a trivia contest, which is kind of